Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness, as regular listeners to this show know, we often talk about psychedelics and particularly the upsurge in psychedelic therapy these days. And just as a little plug, I want to remind you that you can check out the archive of Expanding Mind shows, both on the PRN website, on Podbean, and on my own website, technosis.com. And if you're on the phone, you can call in and get the five most recent episodes at 1-701-719-0890. That's 701-719-0890. And you will find plenty of these discussions. We've been talking, of course, about MDMA therapy, about psychedelics and culture, Burning Man, et cetera, et cetera. But one fascinating topic that we have not covered on the show is the drug ketamine, the dissociative anesthetic discovered or invented really in the early 1960s, and which has come to play, to my mind, both surprisingly and not surprisingly, an increasingly significant role in the discussion of psychedelic therapies. Let's just assume for the moment that we can class ketamine as a psychedelic along with the classics like LSD and psilocybin. It's really remarkable the kinds of research that's coming in about particularly ketamine's capacity to work with people who are suffering from major depression that is resistant to other treatment. So that's a very unhappy portion of the population. As someone who's, as they say, struggled with depression in my own life, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for people who are really at rock bottom. And the fact that anything can help these folks out is great. And the fact that it's ketamine that seems to be working extraordinarily well is kind of remarkable, because ketamine is an extremely fascinating drug. And even among people who are interested in psychedelics, it has a somewhat peculiar profile. It's a bit weirder than a lot of the classic psychedelics, at least in terms of the kind of culture and discourse that has developed around this remarkable substance. It also has very different effects in some ways, and also recognizably psychedelic ones in other ways. So I was kind of tickled, as they say, to find out that there's a new book out on ketamine called The Ketamine Papers, Science, Therapy, and Transformation. And I was more tickled to discover that the editor of the book, which is being published by MAPS, which we've, of course, talked about often on this show, is Phil Wolfson, a doctor, psychotherapist, and psychiatrist who's been working in this field for a very long time, really a remarkable character, as well as a long struggler in the zones, some of them sort of beneath the radar, in order to work on using these substances for therapeutic purposes. He was of that first wave of therapists that used MDMA for therapy before MDMA was scheduled in the mid-1980s. So he's been working on this stuff for a very long time. And a number of his articles are in the Ketamine Papers, including the final article, which is about the idea of transformation, which we'll talk about later on, because it's a term, you know, we hear a lot these days. It gets bandied about to describe pretty much any practice and event, from, Burning Man to yoga to, to drugs that, create some kind of, change. And then we talk about transformation, but it's not always clear exactly what transformation means. When is it rhetoric? When is it really engaged in the full unflowering of a life? So I'm very happy to feel decided to talk to us here on Expanding Mind. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the lovely introduction.
Of course. You know, I thought we'd talk, dive in talking a little bit about, I mean, I know that you're also doing, you are the principal investigator on the MAPS-sponsored study on MDMA and life-threatening illness, which I definitely want to get to. But I want to lay out the sort of ketamine tale first. So I'd love if you could just give us a little brief, you know, biography, if you will, of ketamine, when it appeared on the scene, when its psychedelic effects were discovered. And also a little bit about the neurological system that it works on, because of course it's not targeting the serotonin system that we associate with the classic psychedelics. So if you could just give us a little thumbnail to get us started, that would be wonderful.
Well, I may rattle on, so interrupt me, I will.
I will.
it has a remarkable history. It was really brought into our world in the 80s, early on, by Salvador Roquette, who was this quite extraordinary and controversial Mexican psychiatrist who came into the Stan Grof, Stanley Krippner, Richard Jensen world at the Maryland Psychiatric Institute and introduced ketamine as a psychedelic agent that was part of his host of agents, including LSD and then a little later MDA, that he used to produce fantastic voyages in Mexico, especially around Mexico City, with a variety of audiovisual techniques, startlingly negative and impactful. So he came to Maryland, and a bunch of people tripped. Stan Grof in our book has a chapter on that a bit, and sort of Stan Krippner, and there's a bunch of stuff on the interesting guy he was and his methodologies, which are in the psychedelic world are still very much in vogue. So followers of Roquette really constitute a large part of the underground psychedelic psychotherapy world that exists now. And so he produced these amazing journeys, introduced ketamine, and it began to catch on both separately and involved with other psychedelics. One of the noticeable asides of ketamine was that some people who had been depressed actually came out of their depression and felt much better on an ongoing basis. This was picked up anecdotally in the late 1990s. By a group out of NIMH and at Yale, focused around a fellow named Crystal, who's still publishing and doing active work. And what they tried to do was to see if there was an antidepressant effect, which they could separate out as much as possible from the psychedelic effect, war on drugs, you know, not wanting psychedelics to be in vogue or used. And could ketamine become a separate kind of vehicle for an antidepressant response, because the antidepressant drug field has been static for decades now and only partially successful. Success rates for agents like Prozac, Effexor, etc., depending on the study involved, run to 50% or 60%. So there are a large group of people who don't have benefit from antidepressants, perhaps 40% or 50%, plus they have a legion of side effects. So that group became classified as treatment-resistant depression, which meant that they failed on two or more antidepressants. But there was this host of people struggling with long-term depression, short-term depression, who were not responsive. In the early work at NIMH, they found that ketamine produced transient responses of an antidepressant nature immediately, in contrast to antidepressants, which took 2 to 4 to 5 weeks to have an effect because of the so-called blood-brain barrier, which is a physiological, really biochemical barrier, in a sense, for substances to get into nerve endings in the brain. So initially, it was hopeful stuff, and you could see this quick effect, but it vanished. And then with time, people began to apply it as a series, which is where it is currently. So people go to what I call the NIMH protocol, which is a drip of ketamine at 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, so 35 milligrams if you're a 70-kilogram person over 40 minutes. It produces a mild trance state, and people go into either an anesthesiologist's office or a psychiatrist's office, but very medicalized, get an IV under a nurse's supervision and come out after 45 minutes to an hour, rest a bit, and then go on about their lives. It's a very medical procedure. And what's been found is that there has been a very significant drug response to depression with ketamine, especially with what's called this cumulative effect, and people go on to have a maintenance or a series of further ketamine experiences in this intravenous manner. And all around the country, ketamine clinics are sprouting that do this intravenous technique at pretty high cost. People are spending for a series anywhere from $2,400 to $5,000 or more for this series of six intravenous experiences.
Wait, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Is the expense due to the fact that it's a drip? Because, I mean, the substance itself is relatively cheap, and obviously, you know, there's going to be overhead and blah, 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 but is it partly because of the method of it, of taking it?
No, it's because people can make money, Eric.
It's, okay.
It's in vogue. It's not covered by insurance. It may be eventually. I imagine it's going that way. It's off-label, so it's not doctors aren't covered by malpractice. We have an elaborate informed consent in the book that gives a picture of what people have to agree to pose, not put a risk into our lives because they recognize that this is not standard fare. But off-label treatment, I should add, is common in the medical world. So a drug like Prozac, for example, gets an indication for depression, but people use Prozac for all manner of other kinds of emotional and even physical maladies, and that is called off-label. So off-label is not the kiss of death. It just means that within the FDA methodology, just like MDMA is going for with MAPS, an indication for post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, if and when we hope by 2021 MDMA is legal for prescription, people will begin to use it off-label for all manner of things other than PTSD. So that's how it's used. It's avaricious. That's why there's so much variation in the amount charged. In our hands, we have a different method, which we'll talk about, but if I continue the exposition. So there is this dramatic sense of people getting benefit where they couldn't get benefit before. The fact is that psychedelic effects are mildly part and parcel of such treatment. And it really, in my view, if you don't produce at least a trance, you don't have an effect from the drug. What's also controversial about the drug is the so-called mechanism of action, how the drug works. You alluded to it in your introduction, Eric. And so theoretically, and we don't have real proof of it, but what's being espoused in this animal evidence is that another more widely dispersed system than that involved in serotonergic neurotransmitter, dopaminergic or noradrenergic neurotransmitters, the three hearts of what's been proposed as the mechanisms for antidepressant action, that this is a much more widely dispersed system called the glutamatergic system, and that ketamine works within that framework, blocking the inhibition of glutamate. That's not really been shown directly, and there's a lot of controversy because there have been major attempts to try and get a non-ketamine drug similar in action working on the glutamate system but without psychedelic effects to work. And there have been a bunch of chemicals manufactured and studied, but none of them thus far have been shown to have the antidepressant effect. So
let me stop you there, because I wanted to ask about that, because it actually raises a very interesting question. I mean, I remember the first time I read that companies were developing similar compounds with the goal of creating something that would have the antidepressive effects but wouldn't have the psychedelic effects. And, you know, of course, immediately my mind went to one. Okay, it's also because then they can patent it and make a lot of money, that's just how the system works. But more importantly, B was like, why would you assume naturally that the actual antidepressant effects are happening on a subconscious, merely chemical level, chemistry level, and not actually actively involve the experiences themselves, that there's something inside the phenomenology that helps rejigger the system, the whole psychic system. And of course, that question then gets into this basic thing about depression. Yes, it is a disease. Yes, obviously there are ways of treating it as we treat other diseases. And yet, of course, it also has a psychic interior side of it. How do you think about that tension between the compound as another medicine that works, below the surface of consciousness, and as something that stimulates phenomenology experience that itself is part of the healing vector?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question, Eric. I think it's really complex. I would disagree with you that depression's the disease after these many decades of my work. I think it's a problem. It's a state. But whether it's a disease within a disease model, most depressions pass within 3 months. Long-term depressions certainly can be horrible. We think of William Styron's horrible depression, which he never exited, despite being such a formidable mind. It's not always that people, by will or by therapy or by drugs, can exit depression. So there are people who think along a disease model. But it's very hard to look at, complex emotional syndromes as diseases per se. We treat a lot of them, and psychiatry has gotten worse over the decades in wishing to be a black box kind of model where we shove in a drug and we get an outcome and we're not curious about what happens inside people. And unfortunately, that's been the trend because of the triumph of pharma, but it's a limited triumph of corporate pharma, because there's so many people who continue to suffer, so much lack of confidence in the methods, and really, we haven't solved most of the major issues within psychiatry. We still have people embedded in hospitals or in long-term medication that doesn't really free them for their lives. There are many, many unsolved problems. So we've medicated people somewhat successfully some of the time, but by far not all the time. Our methods are not really that voluptuous in a sense. So there is a lot. Most of the people in the field want to put something in and get out a result. They don't really want to know. They don't want to spend their time. And that's basically the model for the clinics that are going. They're run by people who shovel people in and take people out. Kaiser has, to their credit, a bunch of such clinics going. They're trying to work with this method. But I don't think that's the approach of love and of connection, or really the best therapeutic approach. I think, in our hands and others, getting to know people and getting to be with them and using ketamine in this instance, or MDMA as we're doing in our study, as a psychotherapeutic tool and an engagement with people's minds, and really having the experience of that transformation is a far better methodology. To go back to your question, I would say that because ketamine has a minimum, in my view, and I think it's true, and we can look at, the studies, in my view, the production of a trance state is imperative for a result. So what does that mean? If we look at the history of psychiatric interventions, there are many that interrupt consciousness, from complete interruption, as in some of the sleep inductions with barbiturates that the Swiss did, some Americans did way back, to ECT, which is ongoing, which really interrupts and distorts consciousness and interrupts memory, so that the flow of what's difficult and disabling mentally to people is interrupted. You have degrees of that occurring within psychiatric medicine. And the ketamine disruption can range from mild to full. So people in the streets call it the K-hole, as a complete disruption of mind, where for a period of time, people are out in an incredible psychedelic journey in which there's consciousness, but really very little connection to body, and people are transformed from form into energy and have a major disruption and altered state of consciousness, which I think in proper set and setting circumstances can be truly transformative, and we can talk about that as we go on, to the much lesser states of trance, which are also mild disruptions of consciousness. So as we apply in our hands what we call lozenges or sublingual disbursement of ketamine with our people in about 2.5 hour sessions or so, people enter another realm where their negative energy is pretty much suspended. Their ability to be empathic towards themselves, not at the level of MDMA, I call ketamine a euphorogen rather than an empathogen, where their accessibility to themselves is greater and where there's a major reduction in cognition. So there's an interruption of flow. So my view is that if you do it just as a drug, you will get interruptions of flow, and you'll do that 6 times, 12 times, 20 times over weeks to months. And those disruptions, if they're skillful, will add to the possibility on a psychological mechanistic level that people will leave their depression, their obsessional life behind and move into an arena where there's new mind, new connection possible. But I think that has to occur. There has to be some degree of disruption of the flow of mind. The problem is that with many people, mind is very rigid, and people have what I call a rubber band effect. They return to their regular mind with great alacrity, and the effects of the medication or disruptions are ineffectual. So we have a spectrum of people who respond to the drug, and we're just beginning to analyze that. I've just created what I'm calling the K-Data Project to put into a computer world an assessment of K projects around the country who will participate in a multi-center across the board study of our practices, and that's just going to begin.
Excellent. Well, that sounds good. Now, I want to stay with that last point you made, because it gets to this question about transformation. And, you know, just to say it again, it's a term that people use a lot. You know, in popular culture, in the sort of Burning Man world, in psychedelic culture, in yoga, and da 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 da. It's a common way to gesture towards the fact that this experience you're going to have during the experience is definitely going to be transformative, at least temporarily. But what I've observed, and I think that you would agree, and you just sort of refer to it specifically in relationship to ketamine therapy, is this rubber band effect. And I'm really glad you address it in your book and you talk about this problem, because it's very clear that temporarily people can be relieved of their burdens. They can see possibilities. They can feel themselves changes. They can new assemblages emerge, new hopes, shifts in their body. All these wonderful things can happen with a wide variety of practices. But most of the time, I don't know how much, but quite a lot of the time, including my own experience, the rubber band hits. And so then what you find, what I see looking kind of as a cultural observer, a lot of these groups is that, okay, well, it didn't, you know, on some level, the secret is that it didn't really work that well in the long term. So what you have to do is go back and do it again. So then you get these kind of transformation junkies who return to the experience again and again and again to have that sense of possibility, but it doesn't really stick. And so from the outside, you're like, well, I'm not really sure what you're doing at that point. And it certainly isn't quite what I mean by transformation. So, you know, that's obviously a huge topic. But in your work with MDMA or with ketamine, in terms of protocols, in terms of intentionality, in terms of the other kinds of aspects of human life that can be brought into these experiences to increase the likelihood that there's some kind of lasting, integrated change. That, I mean, in a way, that's the kind of like, that's the magic button or the whatever, the spell that makes it really work. But what in your experience has helped support that genuine transformation as opposed to just returning to the transient effects?
Well, again, well put, Eric. You're a wonderful observer of culture, and I've always admired that and liked our exchanges about such things. So, yeah, no, you look at yourself personally and you say, how much have I changed? Or I'm a secular Buddhist guy, I write about it. You know, how much does following what I've called the awakened tenfold path as a, you know, an enlargement of the eightfold path, following that, how much do we change as we meditate, yoga, you know, go? How much do we change and how much do we stay the same? How much do our arguments with people, our arguments with ourselves repeat and repeat? You know, you could look on the larger cultural level. Is Trump the rubber band effect? Why didn't, you know, decades now from the 60s, I'm a 60s guy of anti-misogyny, anti-racism, you know, acceptance of all kinds of one of aspects of being. Why has that morphed into such a terrible reaction? It's the rubber band effect. Why haven't people seen their true self-interest when you have a criminal, you know, posturing himself and he's going to take all your money, but somehow you think he's God? You know, it's like, you know, this consistency of self, which Buddhists like to talk about there being no intrinsic self. Well, there may be no intrinsic self, but it's damn hard to get rid of. However, the lack of intrinsic self is, you know, there's a lot of contradiction there, a lot of work that we need to do with ourselves and with our loved ones. I would say enthusiastically, however, and optimistically, if I take the MDMA study we're doing, we're just sitting with our 16th person in another room out of our 18 subjects, and we've completed 12, we're in the middle with the next four, and we should be done in April. And these are people with cancer and other life-threatening illnesses who've been pretty traumatized by their illnesses and also bring their earlier trauma with them. I would say that we're having a remarkable set of experiences with people, and people are leaving here feeling and experiencing themselves differently to a person, and freed of a lot of their pain and more alive to the possibilities of their lives. Now, that's occurring in probably the most unprecedentedly intense psychotherapy that's been arranged for free by public donation to MAPS, you know, where people are having, you know, 3 or 5 overnight sessions in our home, and the 20 or more psychotherapy sessions over a 3 to 5 month period. And, you know, both the therapy and the work with the substance are profound. And it, you know, it's so intense with two therapists that, you know, it's pretty hard to maintain the same view of yourself. Plus, MDMA is such a wonderful empathogen. We can't wait for it to get legalized. We try to keep it legal for just this kind of use. And I would say the same is happening with ketamine in our practice. We don't have the data yet, so we will soon. But I would say that probably 70% of our group we're up to now, 78 people who have been in our treatment domain, I would say at least 70% are having quite significant changes in their behavior, their view of themselves, and their relationship with others. So all three major parameters of connection to self, to others, to community, to loved ones. So I feel really optimistic about it, but at the same time, I also see where we don't have that effect and that the results in all of us are partial and require a multifactorial approach to life. You know, if we don't do relationship, we're missing on that zone. If we don't do community, we're isolating. If we don't do self-examination, we're living on the surface. So, you know, living a thoughtful, deep life is a it's an incredible undertaking, and it requires our love and support as a community for that. And, you know, there are going to be aberrations and successes, one step forward, two step backward, three step forward. That's inevitable, because there's no, you know, kind of apocalyptic ending of a good sort that we can be confident in. When will that happen? I thought we'd make the revolution back in 1969, 1971, when I went to Cuba in 68 illegally. I thought I'd end up as the Minister of Health, the new government, you know. And then I wanted to be Che Guevara and pursue, you know, into the mountains, good health and barefoot medicine things. And God knows the list of things we've been down that, you know, have been great experiences, but haven't rocked our socks altogether. So it's an evolving struggle. It's an evolving fun game. You know, it's bittersweet. You know, you get so far and then suddenly you're thrown into the swamp. And if we've emptied the swamp, all we left are now new crocodiles swarming in. You know? It's like, Middle East in flames, you know, and millions of refugees and people bombing their own people to smithereens, you know, the Congo's a wreck. You know, what's really going on? It's not all beautiful. And yet each of our lives, I mean, so many people right now are in grave depression and anxiety, as am I, from the election and the throwing out of anything that's progressive and the turning back of the clock and the threatening of, you know, any New Deal leftovers. You know, it's alarming. And so many people are in despair right now. And I can't agree with that any more than let's turn out for the Women's March on the 21st. Let's be activists. Let's stand with Standing Rock. But that doesn't mean we're going to win. It just means we continue.
Yeah, great. That's a great riff on both the political and the psychological level. But since you brought up our changed world, the world changed, our world changed, America changed. But since America's part of the world changed. One of the things that I've been dealing with is not just this kind of just depression and anxiety in relationship to the just how right wing things seem to be going and all the questions and all the disappointment and frustration about, you know, where I think things should be, et cetera, et cetera. There's also another sense which I'm tempted to say is even slightly psychedelic in a not fun way, which is that the post-truth era that we've entered into, the way in which social media and the internet and certain ways of performing politics have created this kind of sort of loopy hall of mirrors, a labyrinth of mirrors effect in the media, where it feels like some kind of reference point that for all of the challenges was still existing, at least in public discourse, is kind of gone, or at least threatens to disappear. And on the other side of that, I see just sort of a kind of just war of stories of algorithmic effects to sway, you know, propaganda at a micro level that we haven't even imagined before. I mean, a real terrifying vision sometimes I have of trying to understand what happened in the election, of trying to understand right-wing media and how it operates. And how it feeds into simultaneously a kind of reactionary desire to like hold the wall against all of these new others, black people and lesbians and all the crazy people we've got to hold the wall against. And at the same time, there's something even more revolutionary and radical and nihilistic about this new right wing, especially if you look at how it operates online. And it's producing in me a very like, you know, kind of creepy sense that reality, the rules of reality are shifting a little bit. So it is very, very psychologically intense times. And, you know, how do we navigate between being, recognizing what's happening in the world, thinking about the world, doing what we can, even if we might lose, and trying to cultivate an interior life where we don't just give into anxiety and depression? I mean, I'm having a terrible time with that in a lot of ways. How do we keep our little island when we know it's an island in this raging sea?
Well, Eric, it's always been an island. The question is, how big an island are we? Long Island? Are we Queens? Are we, you know, Madagascar? Are we Australia, which is a big goddamn island? You know, so we're always an island. We've never been a majority. But there was a period of time where there was an upswing, and now there's a Great Depression because people are so disenfranchised as we look ahead in so many ways. And, you know, the question of what is fundamentalism, so you have Islamic fundamentalism, but you have this kind of what I'm afraid I will call stupid fundamentalism in America. And it's not hard to understand that in a certain cultural, deep psychological way. I think of James Hillman and going into the deep interiors of us. What has been the bombardment of the average American person who watches 5 to 6 hours of TV, who you know, is completely bombarded by messages of consumption? And how could people not lose sense of who they are over these, you know, 60 or 70 years of media and, you know, increasing impoverization, really, in the last years, especially by, you know, the elite of the rich, who more and more take over culture, and by there being a complete lack of alternative. When you really look, years ago, and I've been delinquent, I started, I still have it, a website called Profound Democracy, one word, 1D, because I felt that the major impetus for any change in our society was going to be money out of politics, because everyone's paid off. You know, maybe not Bernie Sanders, but if you look at the amount of contributions flowing to the Democratic Party from all kinds of horrors, you know, the Hillary Goldman Sachs story, and you look at what's going on, how can anything but dominant American capitalism, which doesn't pay its share, not be triumphant? So I wrote a constitutional amendment, term limits for Supreme Court justices, and there was a bit of a movement, but it never really caught on. And when I bring it up now, people say, oh, that'll never happen. And I really don't care about things that supposedly will never happen. Who thought Trump would happen, you know? We have to stick with some sense of what really makes sense has to happen. So, you know, there's a deep cultural impingement on our minds, all of us. We talk about, you know, sustainability and leaving, you know, this economy. Who can do that? How do we put oil aside? You know, we have a debate in my men's group over, you know, within Standing Rock, there were two points of view. There was the point of view of supporting the Native American movement, which totally deserved to be supported in every way. And then there was this business about energy and oil and the pipeline and standing clear of oil development, you know, and all that has meant. And yet, you know, we drive our cars, which was several of my men friends' point of view. We have huge carbon imprints. We fly everywhere to the conferences on, you know, on alternative energy. You know, there's that famous Gore thing of him flying within the documentary he produced as he's talking about, you know, sustainability and alternative energy. You know, it's a very hard nut to crack, and we're all in it. So, you know, we need to create sharing and love and brotherhood and reality about this and community. And it's not going to be easy. And we have to really.
I want to cut it here just because you were talking about petroleum. And I have to say one of the true jewels of your ketamine papers book is Stan Groff's article about his experience with ketamine. Is a wonderful account, like a very resonant and you know, really, really direct and very interesting. And he talks about some of his experiences, including some more nightmarish, dark ones. And he has this incredible vision of basically the petroleum demons. Like, yep. He tunes into the petroleum world. He understands it kind of esoterically as well as politically, and it really opens him up into you know, a post-petroleum mind frame, and gives him this big, you know, kick in the pants towards, you know, paying attention to renewable energy. But also, and this I think is in a way a more important thing, is to recognize that there is an esoteric dimension to our relationship to petroleum. The petroleum is a very peculiar material that has its own relationship to death and the organic cycles. Yep. And that in some sense, it's kind of a weird demon that we've made a pact with. And the whole 20th century was just this result of this kind of pact. And the pact has been coming due for a while. And it's a really beautiful, section. I mean, it's, not particularly germane to ketamine necessarily, but it's really a wonderful example of how other people's trips can actually really illuminate your own worldview.
Well, thank you very much. I loved his piece, and it was really fun to edit it and to work with him a bit on it. And I think it is about ketamine, actually. I think one of the amazing things about ketamine experiences, having been quite experienced in it myself, is what comes up. And each time one does a ketamine trip, something else comes up within our therapeutic framework, within our personal framework. As long as you use the drug as a sacred drug, the experiences of ketamine are mind-blowing because they're often philosophical. They lead to the deepest kind of questioning. They lead to deep experiences in Stan's experience. And you're quite right. He also describes sitting up against a brick wall in his ketamine journey, and endlessly watching this brick wall. So ketamine journeys are not always, the consummate kind of amazing explication of mind, but they tend that way, and that's why I call them large transformations. So even I always ask people when they come back in our clinical setting from a journey, how are you different? You will always come back a bit different. Can you recognize it? Can you hold it? So aside from the chemical effect, there is this sense of amazing impact on consciousness in it. Unfortunately, people often forget the experience. It's hard to hold on to it for many people many of the time, but it's there and inside us. So I think it informs our interior potentially in great ways. Of course, it loosens our shackles to form and really creates a sense of energy. The first time I experienced it, I thought it was akin to dying because I had no form whatsoever. I was just complete pure energy. And I had never, in all my voyages, ever had that kind of experience. And in that sense, ketamine has a unique profile from other psychedelics, classical or whatever those, I think, silly distinctions are. But it's an opportunity in certain ways. And even the trance, lower dose than the what we'd call the intramuscular way, produce all kinds of experiences that are interesting and shake up our assumptions. So in that sense, there is transformation in the book. In my transformation section, I have a little chart that's kind of both mirthful and an attempt for us to look at transformation, because there are trivial transformations and there are giant ones. Having a child, that's a giant transformation, changes your life. And to the extent you are aware of your parenting, changes your life profoundly. If you shuck it off, it doesn't change it so much, So there are these trip transformations, there are these giant things we take on in life. And I think we should be more generous with the idea of transformation and not hold ourselves quite so still. Nothing happened, I didn't do anything. Because things are happening all the time, and there are varying degrees. But some things are profound even in their smallness.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the points you made in that essay that I really appreciated, was a turn away from, a gentle turn away from the emphasis on peak experiences, the idea that you're going to have one big blowout experience that's going to reset everything and get you going in the right direction, which was, I think that was a popular idea, certainly in the 60s and 70s. I mean, a lot of therapies, not just with psychedelics, but a lot of therapies were about like the huge breakthrough, overwhelming, mind-blowing, resetting experience that was going to like change everything. Whereas it seems to me that, I mean, I share your view that that transformation is a more incremental process that goes down as well as up, that sometimes peak experiences can be extraordinarily illuminating, and sometimes they don't necessarily lead anywhere except to the knowledge that those kinds of ecstasies can happen, which is itself kind of a wonderful thing. So there does seem to be something less sexy but more important about acknowledging the incremental changes, because then the material of your daily life opens up as a possible field for real change. It's just not necessarily so razzle dazzle, you know, that I, you know, start to create a new habit or whatever it is that I'm doing.
Well, it's enriching. Right now, I'll tell you a small transformation in the city. I'm in my little office and the rain is torrential. I'm up on a little mountain in San Anselmo Ross, and we get the brunt of the storm. So it's pouring. I'm looking out at trees blowing. So what's the transformation? Well, you know, the beginning of this season in October, we're in the drought. We think the drought's going to kill us. I've been worried the mountain's going to burn. You know, what's going to happen? The drought continues, agriculture. And so, you know, you have this anxiety, drought anxiety. And now we've had a really incredible October, November, and here it's pouring December, and I've transformed. I'm not worried about the drought. I'm really happy. And now people are worried about flooding, you know? So I'm really happy not to be worried about the drought or Mount Tam burning or my forest, you know, dying or my garden, you know, drying up. I'm happy. I've had a transformation.
That's what it actually is. Kind of amazing, as the sheer joy of rain when you've been in a drought situation on Saturday night here in the or Friday night this last weekend in the city. I went to see Chris Robinson Brotherhood and came back. I was in a real ecstatic state and walked all the way home in the rain, and it was just marvelous. I enjoyed every gust, every chill was a real delight.
A slogan. I always say, I love the weather. So some people say, it's going to rain. I've got seasonal affective disorder. I love the weather. I want to love the dark. I want to love the light. You know, I just want to be in it, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that kind of appreciation is also something that comes about through, you know, through practice, through being, you know, more and more tuned in. And we don't have tons of time left. And I did want to give a nod to some of the idea of secular Buddhism and some of the ways that Buddhism and Buddhist practice has influenced your work. I mean, you talk about that one of the things that is more likely to result in genuine transformation from your perspective is that that people are also involved in meditation, contemplation, other kinds of slow and steady transformative work. And you even talk a little bit about the way one of my favorite topics, which is how Buddhist teachings and meditation practices and protocols can themselves be used within psychedelic experience to illuminate, to open up, to transform within working with that in that space. So I'd love to just hear you talk a little bit about what role Buddhism plays in your work and in your ways of thinking about the transformative potential of MDMA and ketamine, as well as just, you know, living this life of transformation.
Well, thank you for that question. It's an opportunity for me. So years ago, I got turned on to Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, and specifically through two teachers, Tsultra Malioni and Namkhai Norbu, who was a Tibetan teacher of great consequence. And the great gift of Namkhai Norbu to me, and I think to countless others, was to teach essence teaching, that is, that stripped of attachment, which is really the heart of the Four Noble Truths, that if we can get to an emptiness space, variously called Dzogchen, primordial awareness, people like in the internal family systems world call it self with a capital S, but basically a beingness in which we can refuge within non-attachment and just essence being and clarity and spaciousness and return to it when we get lost, that we improve the quality of our minds, life, and connections. And within that framework, a compassion arises for ourselves and for others, independent of substances. But at the same time, in my substance world, what I began to understand for myself, and maybe it applies to others, is that the realm of what arises in substance work experientially is just that space illuminated. That space illuminated is kind of the highlight of Dzogchen. I can't emphasize more that this is the essence space. So when we can come back to that, either through the and know the high-lit space of the great antics of our mind under psychedelics, or in the more open and less dramatic spaces of ordinary daily mind when we return to it, that serves as a reference to our lives, really. If I'm not wanting, if I'm not in the poisons, as Buddhism calls them, of desire and avarice or hatred or rejection and aversion, and I really do process that I'm an ignorant soul and I don't know what I'm talking about, that I live in a very different kind of openness, and that openness serves me and serves others.
Well, I'm curious about, you know, you started off with Vajrayana work, and more recently you wrote an article which is available on your website about a secular Buddhism. We've had Stephen Batchelor on this show. I admire his work tremendously, and as in my life, I have increasingly come towards quote unquote more secular positions about a lot of things, without closing the door on all these extraordinary realms that often are mixed up with more religious forms. So I'm curious how important you see the sort of development of secular Buddhism is, and how, what kind of role psychedelics can play in that sort of larger cultural conversation, or if it's remained something a little bit on the side for some people, or whether it actually plays a really important role in developing a kind of different mode of the Dharma for our world today.
Well, thanks for bringing up Stephen, who's been a root teacher of mine in recent years and a colleague who I'm privileged to bounce off of, and who's been the great source of my own interest in secular Buddhism, Buddhism without beliefs. And I would say that most, not all, teachers of Buddhism in our culture have had psychedelic experiences as well, and some of them are very open about it and open about the contribution of psychedelics to their exegesis and the not compartmentalization but compatibility of those two experiences. And that, you know, an ethical practice such as which secular Buddhism is, wrapped around the Eightfold Path, which is really a pragmatic path, as Stephen and I describe it humbly myself, a pragmatic path to living authentically and living in self and community, that you know, informs our life more than an arbitrary psychedelic experience. But psychedelic experiences also inform the other by increasing our imagination, by increasing our improvisational capacity, our relationship to intuition, our sense of possibility in the world, our sense of universality. And, I think there's a great complementarity and integration possible. And I don't think isolated psychedelic experience is entirely valuable. I think it gets us to go somewhere, but I think we have to use it in daily life to make it meaningful. And people get lost in addiction, and we should add ketamine can be that for people. And we think of John Lilly, we have some of his story in the book, but certainly out in the world there are a bunch of ketamine addicts who have no relationship to that other and are living in dependence on a drug which can be very difficult and can be fully absorbing in a kind of different way of addiction, because it seems to me the addiction basis is mental involvement and wanting to be in the space of ketamine rather than withdrawal particularly. So I see this as an integration in my life, and I think in other people's lives as well. Sounds like in your life, Eric. And I encourage that integration And rather than having psychedelic specialists or Buddhist specialists, I think we should have broadly developed guides who are our friends and hold our hands and we hold theirs, so we don't have arrogance and we have balance and we have community as we develop.
Yeah, no, I really, you know, hear on that one, especially on the way of reconceiving the role that we can play for others, not as authorities so much as maybe temporary authorities, but really emphasizing friends and the notion of friendship or spiritual friends, even sort of colleagues as a sort of model for shifting out of the authority structures that go along, not just with traditional religion, but also, of course, with some aspects of therapeutic work. I mean,
or ideologies. I like brothers and sisters a lot. I really like that. Friends, brothers, sisters. That's kind of the terminology that turns me on.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm glad you raised that issue about ketamine addiction. We don't have time to talk about it now, but it is an important thing to mention that is a particular a feature of this most peculiar substance. I was very happy, by the way, that read at one point where you were describing the words that people most use to describe their ketamine experience when they come out of it, and the top one was weird, and that's good. That's good for me because the title of my dissertation in my next book is called High Weirdness. So it's I take the weird very seriously. I was happy to get a little. Anyway, we gotta wrap it up here, Phil. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. Once again, we were talking with Phil Wolfson, and the book is The Ketamine Papers. There's also a lot of fun stuff on Phil's website, philwolfsonmd.com. Until next week, keep your minds open.